Welcome to SAA, and we're hoping this being the first session of the conference, you're awake, barring any jet lag, and you're ready to be informed on open source software. I'm Paula Jabloner, the senior archivist at the Computer History Museum at Mountain View, California, and I'm replacing Lisa Miller as session chair, and there's some other replacements too. Our first speaker will be Susan Hamburger. Susan is currently manuscripts cataloging librarian at Pennsylvania State University. She has previously worked at a number of repositories in both Virginia and Florida. Susan has written and presented extensively on archival, literary, and historical subjects. These topics included these topics are as diverse as Florida horse racing, creating diversity in libraries, and Bruce Springsteen. Susan holds a PhD and MA in history from Florida State University and an MLS from Rutgers. Our second speaker will be Jennifer Harp, who is archivist and records manager at Mount St. Mary's University in Maryland. Jennifer's research interests are as diverse as Susan's. They include self-deposit archival collections, increasing access to archival materials for users with disabilities, and early American obstetrical practices. Jennifer also raises guide dogs, and in previous years, you might have seen her walking around SAA training a guide dog. Jennifer holds a BA in American Studies from Gettysburg College and an MLS from the University of Maryland. And our last speaker will be Lisa Miller, who's replacing Mary Taylor, who couldn't be here today. Lisa is Associate Archivist at the Hoover Institution Archives at Stanford University. Prior to joining the Hoover, she worked a dozen years at the National Archive. Lisa has an MLS and an MA in American Studies from the University of Minnesota. She is also co-chair of the Metadata Roundtable and once actually presented a paper on sheep and cattle grazing records. So welcome. And here's Susan.
Good morning. I may be coughing a bit because I'm getting over a cold, and that'll cut my time down a little bit. While I have a title, Oliver spits out a finding aid using ContentDM with a database. Oliver is not spitting out a finding aid yet, and we're not using ContentDM yet. And that's what we're going to be talking about in the process of deciding what we're going to do. A little bit of background. At Penn State, we have a homegrown system called Oliver, because of Oliver Wendell Holmes, the archivist, not the jurist. And we've migrated several times over different platforms and different systems to get to Oliver. And we've merged five databases into one. And we worked on exporting the EAD tag data from Oliver in its previous incarnation. And we've also been creating finding aids using XML that I've been doing from scratch for years. And we looked at some way of stitching together the database export of the container information that did not have any scope and content note or biographical notes with the word narratives. And that was one way of putting things together. We wanted to find a way of doing something a little bit better. This was one iteration that we had where we could export, if you look at the create EAD text, what we would get would be an EAD text file, and then I would marry that together with the narrative. But we want to figure out how can we automate these generation of EAD finding aids from the database, and most importantly, what I'm going to be talking about today is how can we provide a federated search tool for the finding aids once we have them out there. Rather than my creating individual finding aids, we want them to automate and then provide better access. And what software is out there that we could use that could be either open source or proprietary, depending upon what was available. Currently, this is what we have, a basic flat file, HTML, listing of the finding aids, and I have a subject list. There is no search capability. You can look within those subject areas, but there's no cross-collection searching. And we wanted to find some way of doing that rather than coming to the individual finding aids. Some of the issues that we're having to deal with, that the special collection staff does not know EAD. I'm the only one who's been doing EAD for years. We have a new processing coordinator who does know EAD, but that's not part of her job to create them. And the information technology crew over in the library, they don't know EAD either, and they're barely literate with XML and XSLT. So they have a little bit of knowledge, but not enough to know what we're doing. And the dean does not want them to do development anymore. It has to be an out-of-the-box solution. So these are the main issues that we had to deal with. We looked at DLXS and thought, oh, it's got some great capabilities. Can we use that? Can we do that? And we looked at other options. One of the things that we decided to do was to make a list of all of our priorities. What do we really need to have as a deal breaker? What do we need to have to go online? And then what do we need that would be maybe 2 years out, sort of like a wish list, and made a list of all the options and listed them here and what the search results could produce. We've developed a task force called the Finding Aids Platform Working Group that was charged by ITEC with a couple of people from each of the different areas. And we were charged to look and evaluate what existing products were out there that could meet the criteria that we were developing so that we could implement something. We did a lot of surveying, looking around on the archives listserv, asking people, looking at other people's websites, and we came up with 5 potential products. The Archeon Archivist Toolkit, Content DM, there was version 4.2 at the time, DLXS version 12 at the time, and XTF were the 5 that we identified as possibles. And then we decided we were going to assess them and evaluate the products and see how much this is going to cost us, not only in money but in staff time, making up our list of prioritized criteria. And then we got together in groups, mostly 2 people, one from Special Collections or me, who came from a Special Collections background, and a tech person. So we'd have a technical person available to evaluate that end of the product, and then developed a matrix for our evaluation and graded the criteria. It's like from 1 is required all the way down to desired and where things fit within the back end, the specifications. Each one got a ranking number and dealt with rights management and the search functionality of these issues and things that we needed to have, things that were nice to have, and things that were absolutely essential, including the end user output, which was mostly an important area. Then we looked at things that were desirable to have, but we didn't put them in the priority category, whether they could be findable through the RLG spiders and Google, federated search support, and linking from the CAT record to the metadata and the finding aid. I have an example of the appendix that we came up with. This is the meat of the report that grouped the issues that we wanted to cover and evaluate based upon the back-end processing and scroll down here, describing the format and standards for the finding aids in each of the products. What we ended up with evaluating was Content DM and DLXS. The licensing and support issues that we had, what could it do, what could it not do, did they even deal with it, the rights management issues, can you restrict it at certain levels, and the search functionality within the product, and what end user outputs did we have, the formats that it came out in. And all of this is up on my website, which I'll give you the URL at the end, so you don't have to worry about trying, why can't I read this? It's going too fast. Discovery and sharing, and then the cost of what things cost for licenses and what local customization would be required. And this was a real key area. Because the dean didn't want them to do anything with development, how much customization we would have to do versus what we would want to do would be a real big issue to deal with. So we looked at the products and decided that neither Archeon or the Archivist Toolkit were able to do this kind of federated searching, so we eliminated them immediately. And XTF didn't have the technical support that we needed because of all our constraints within the library. We like DLXS, and we like the open source idea, but it's very hard to ingest it. And that would have taken the techies, and they didn't want to deal with it. They started pointing us toward ContentDM, which makes it easy to get into, but the end product really looks bad and works bad for finding aids. Then we talked with ContentDM people and found that they were looking into developing a new version that would include finding aids. And so that became the focus of our group, that what we wanted to do was to work with them in developing this new version, this beta version that would deal with finding aids, and give them our sample finding aids for a variety, like I think we did 3 different finding aids that would be typical of what we might put out, and give them our specifications and say, here's all the criteria that we want, and look at what they can actually come up with in their beta version. And if the product meets our release, then we would implement. And if it doesn't, we go back to the drawing board. Well, our time frame was to create a best practices guidelines, which we did, clean up the data in Oliver because a lot of it did not have the scope and content note in the database. It was in a Word file. We're still working on that. The export tools to generate the EAD finding aid, we had it in a previous version, but the techie took it down so she could work on it, and that's still not working. So if I want a finding aid, I still have to go back and create it by hand. And the XSL style sheets for that have not been created yet because they're working on other issues. We did send our finding aids out to ContentDM for the beta testing. They were initially going to have it done by this summer. We haven't heard anything back yet that what their progress is. And we would launch the next release with the finding aids in January. Well, since we haven't heard back from them, we don't have anything yet to report. And so we're still in the wait and see kind of mode. One of the things we'd have to deal with ongoing development would be testing this for usability. Can folks actually search across the finding aids and get results and do some in-house testing with staff and faculty and students, which will come down the road once we get something up, and then continue modifications and scan and look for new products that come out because you never can settle for just what you found. We'd have some problems with staffing resources. We need to work together with the techies and the people who know the materials so that it will move forward. You can't rely only on special collections people to do it because they don't have the technical expertise. And the iTech folks need the prodding because they have so much on their plate that you don't know what they're going to drop on your end and move on to something else that has a different priority. And the Digital Library Technologies is another unit in the library that doesn't belong to the library, but they're responsible for a lot of the computer support and server support, and they have to be on board and supportive to get this stuff onto a development server to make sure we can test it and then into a production server. They're going to need some more training. The people in iTech know some things. They know a little bit more about other things and need to know a lot more about a lot of other stuff, especially with Oracle and understanding EAD finding aids. To that end, they did come to one of the SAA workshops that I brought to Penn State where they learned a bit about what goes into a finding aid. And so they have a little bit more understanding of what we're talking about. And since they don't use it, they'll need an XSLT refresher. The infrastructure and policies are dictating the direction that we're taking. We wanted to do open source. We wanted to evaluate open source, but because of all these constraints, we could not look at that as the only option. And we may end up going open source if some other product comes along, As I had said, you know, the DLXS looks great, but we can't ingest it easily. And then we just have to have a dedicated staff with expertise that we don't have to be able to do an open source software. What I would recommend if you're looking into open source software or even an off-the-shelf product, you have to look at determining your needs and then systematically evaluate the products that you're going to use, similar to the kinds of criteria that we developed. Set up your timeline so it's not an open-ended, it's going to go on forever kind of project. The iTech folks are really interested in beginning of a project, the middle of the project, and an end to the project. Even if the project isn't over and completed to your satisfaction, there is an end date, and then you have a new group charged with the actual implementation. And you need to know what your technical limitations are. We don't have the skills to actually do programming, and the folks that have those skills are either overworked or unwilling, or the dean from on high says, no, that's not where we're putting all of our money. We don't want you to do that. We want you to find a product that you can use. And then the big part is including the key personnel in the planning. As much as the folks in Special Collections would like to be able to do all this on our own, without the support from iTech for looking at these materials and looking at the software that's out there and the capabilities of it and understanding the technical aspects of it, and the DLT folks and saying, okay, yeah, we'll give you server space for it. If you don't include them in the planning, they're not at the table and they're not in part of the discussion and they don't see you on their radar. So if anyone wants to look at, in detail, the report that we came up with, I have it posted up on my webpage at Penn State, and I believe we're going to have it up either on the wiki or on the program from here. Thank you.
Okay, so my part of this presentation is going to be slightly different than some of the other projects that are discussed, and there's a number of reasons for this. The first is I'm going to be talking about a product called DSpace, which some of you may have heard about, some of you may not have. It resembles a little more closely a commercial out-of-the-box product, but it is a completely open-source piece of software. I'm also not going to go overly heavy on the technical aspects. First of all, I don't know every single nitty-gritty piece of the technical parts of all of this. And also because I think that when we're talking about this, we're still in the planning and thinking about these phases, and so I don't want to overwhelm you with all of that kind of jargon before you really think about whether you can do this or not. The other reason is that when we're talking about DSpace, we're typically talking about institutional repositories, which are kind of a unique animal at most institutions, and they often do not fall under archives. However, I'm going to argue that they probably should, if not in the beginning, at some point in the future. And the other piece is that DSpace is very unique. It has a self-deposit and a self-cataloging feature. So once you get the system up and running, your users and your contributors are doing most of the interaction with the system rather than yourselves. So I wanted to provide a basic definition of an institutional repository for those of you who maybe are not familiar with this. This comes from Clifford Lynch, and I think that the most important part of this is the piece that I've highlighted in red. When we talk about that it's an organizational commitment to the stewardship of digital materials, long-term preservation, organization, and access or distribution. If that doesn't echo the mission statement of an archives, I don't know what does. And that's another reason why I think we should be thinking about this as we think about what we're doing in our own archives. So, very essentially, meaning in practice, institutional repositories that are already established and working, they are typically an online archive of a university's scholarly output, kinds of materials you find in them, working papers, scholarly articles, conference presentations, master's theses, doctoral dissertations, books, book chapters. However, If we broaden the description, which some people are beginning to do, and we'll talk about that a little later, it's really an online archive of an institution's output. That could be anything from annual reports to photographs to data sets. It just depends on how creative you want to be. So let me give you, I told you, this is the only slide on the technical aspects of DSpace. Very, very, very light. It was developed by MIT and Hewlett-Packard Labs and released in 2002. It runs on Unix, Linux, or a similar operating system. Now, sometimes that can be a slight issue. Some smaller institutions do not have programmers and IT people who can use Unix or Linux, but sometimes you can get around that. It's written in Java, and it uses a relational database to store and retrieve its data. Now, it's built on PostgreSQL SQL, which is an open source relational database, but you can substitute something that you purchase, like Oracle. Okay, so features. DSpace has all kinds of things that it can do. First of all, it accepts any file type. Putting a file into DSpace is literally as simple as attaching a document to an email. That is the extent of putting something into this system. And you can put anything you want in there. Data sets, you can put photographs, you can put videos, you can put Word documents, you can put PDFs, it doesn't matter. It has two levels of preservation. It has bit-level preservation, meaning every single piece of that file remains the same over time. It also has functional preservation, so the files actually change to support more immediate access by your users. So they don't have to do anything fancy to get to it, they just open the file. Within that, you also have three levels under that, supported, known, and unsupported file types. When you think of supported files, you're talking about files that can be preserved using file migration or emulation, and typically you're probably familiar with TIFFs and PDFs. These are your supported kind of files. Known are things that are file types that are so popular that it's very likely a third party is going to develop some sort of emulation or migration technique to use for these files. When you think of those, you can think of something like Microsoft Word or the Microsoft Office Suite, where so many people are using them that it's very likely there will be some way to get these. Unsupported really come in when you're talking about very proprietary file types in very specific software pieces. And no one's really sure what's going to happen to these. But the bit level preservation means that if someone really wants it, every single bit of that file is there. And if they can find a way to get to it, they can get to it. It just depends on whether it's important enough to them. So let's talk about a practical lesson in DRUM, in DSpace, and that would be through DRUM, which is the project that I worked on at the University of Maryland. And that's the digital repository at the University of Maryland. Started in 2003 as a faculty initiative. They wanted an institutional repository to house the scholarly output of the faculty and the students. They wanted open source. There were two software solutions that were currently available, DSpace and ePrints, and they decided to go with DSpace. When they looked at evaluation, they wanted the self-deposit, basic and advanced search features, permanent URL assignment, the variety of file types, and that it would be searchable through common search engines. Anything in DSpace you can find through Google or Yahoo and go right to the material itself. Then they had to assign it to a department, which became problematic. A lot of departments weighed in, but only one person was actually willing to take the lead on the project, and she was in the collection development team. And it just happened that she was interested because she had a background in scholarly communication. So it started with information technology. They recruited the collection management person, and finally a graduate assistant was added. And the graduate assistant was actually the only person who was full-time devoted to this project and this project alone. And the reason that it became problematic was that most departments didn't initially see the relevance to their particular department. And that included the archives. Archives saw the long-range potential, but they didn't think or didn't feel ready to be immediately involved with the project. So it went live in 2004, and then work continued on the project. And I just wanted to provide a very basic overview of the way it's laid out. When you develop something within DSpace, it's at collection, community, and subcommunity. And then you can have further divisions under that as well. You can have sub-subcommunities, and you can go down all the way to your heart's content. The University of Maryland basically used the organizational chart for the academic division. So the colleges, the departments, and then the work types, separating the faculty works from the student works that were included. Complications and setbacks, and some lessons that we learned as we went and as we talked to other institutions. Lack of personnel. Susan already mentioned lack of personnel can be a big thing. Because it didn't attract many people at first, it relied very heavily on ITD and on the graduate assistant. And of course, a graduate assistant is only working 20 hours a week. It's not a lot of time, and there's a turnover depending on how long it takes them to complete their degree. The ITD staff were actually only devoted to the project part-time. There was no one who was full-time looking at this at a programming level. So what did we learn? Well, we learned that the technical support, at least in the beginning, when you are customizing and installing the project, was absolutely essential. Having someone who is devoted only to dealing with the little technical issues and the programming and things like that was really would have been very helpful and would definitely have increased the efficiency, at least for the first year that we rolled out the project. Because, of course, once you put the project live, you find all kinds of bugs you didn't know existed before. Now, one thing when we talk about open source, we think, well, there's no customer service. I can't call someone and say, I don't know why this isn't working, but it's not working. Can you fix it? DSpace actually offers a wiki that's very active where programmers can come together and talk about their experiences. They offer script. So our particular institution developed a script that allowed us to authenticate our users and assign them deposit privileges based on our LDAP directory server. And we then provided that script and said, here, if you have something similar, you can already use this piece that's already written. There's a long learning curve, of course, and that happens with any system, and I think Susan illustrated that too. That comes down from administrators of the system to depositors and to researchers. We found this most often among the faculty. The faculty thought this was e-reserves. They didn't understand what this was supposed to be. And so we had to educate everyone multiple times. You know the rule of seven. It takes like 7 times for the information to sink in. Faculty are no exception. So we developed targeted workshops to encourage participation and help them to learn the system. So we had one for editors of peer-reviewed journals. We had one for junior faculty on how this could help them with their tenure track process. One for grad students, so on and so forth. Extensive help documents and FAQs online, and then talks at departmental faculty meetings. Copyright law becomes an interesting thing when you're talking about an institutional repository. There are unique copyright issues that archives typically are not dealing with necessarily, because we're dealing with items that have been published or are about to be published. And what we found was that our contributors were very confused about copyright law and didn't know the flexibility and their rights within the system. And so assumed that they simply could not put things in here because they had signed some sort of publisher's agreement, and that meant that was the end of their rights as they knew it. So we found very quickly Spark's author addendum, which is an interesting one-page item that simply you attach to your author's agreement when you're sending in your item to be published, and it allows you to put your piece into an institutional repository such as Drum after 6 months. After it's been published. And we had a great deal of success with this author's addendum. We put this online so people could just download it and get it real quick. We also provided form letters to publishers asking for permission for items that had already been published. And we did lots more education on copyright law. So what are the benefits of something like Drum? Because, of course, we're talking about open source, and it can equal low cost. Can also be a little higher cost. It really depends. Of course, nothing is free. It still requires time and personnel. But once you get something like DSpace up and running, it's very low maintenance. And like I said, your users are doing a lot of the work for you. And that leads to the self-deposit feature. The other benefit to that is that it may capture items of interest that you may not necessarily have had in your collection development schemes. It also may be things that you just would never have gotten, you didn't know existed in the first place. And those are some of the things that you can get. The searchability through Yahoo and Google are incredible. You can put an author's name in, get the link immediately to all of their pieces, and go right to it. I somehow forgot D, but D is the ability to download the materials. And any user who goes into DSpace, and you can do programming to make this not work like that or to do it differently. Of course, you can watermark photographs, things like that, to make them less usable. But the idea is that your users can get to the material, and they can manipulate it, and they can download it, they can save it, they can print it, they can do whatever they want with it. Of course, they can't, you know, they're bound by an agreement, but within rights, they can actually get to it more easily. And then the self-cataloging, and I think as information professionals, we sometimes think, oh my God, we can't let those people describe these materials themselves. What will they do? We have to be professionally trained. I am one to admit very readily that I am not a cataloging expert. I don't know all of the rules. I don't know all of the descriptive terms. I couldn't possibly, effectively, probably, catalog something on particle physics. But that particle physics professor can. And that person, your people who are depositing, can more accurately use the jargon and the search terms that your users are more likely to be using to find these materials. And it leads to a lot greater results when they actually do these searches. And so I wanted to just close and give you a sense of, okay, now we've talked about what it is, some of the ways you can use it, all of the features, but who's using it? Who's really doing this? The DSpace community alone, and that, you know, there's also eprints and there's some other things, boasts over 200 projects, and it's growing every single day. That's a huge number. An interesting project that was just announced is the 2008 Virtual Olympic Museum. Beijing University will be creating an online repository where any individual who has access to the internet can go and look at materials dealing with the 2008 Olympic Games. The National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education has created a DSpace pilot program. Now, this is available for a fee, but it's a hosted instance of DSpace. And there are about 25 to 30 institutions that have signed up so far, and they're using this for everything from scholarly communication to photograph collections, to other sorts of materials that they have digitized. Interestingly enough, federal legislation is beginning to recognize institutional repositories and open access. There's federal legislation that has been introduced that would require any federal agency with a research portfolio of over $100 million to make any peer-reviewed journal articles publicly available for free 6 months after publication, and that would be in some sort of repository like Drum or like PubMed Central. And then I just gave you four very quick examples to show you the diversity of repositories using this. Smithsonian has an instance of DSpace. The National Library of Finland, I'm not exactly sure what they have in there because I couldn't translate any of their pages, but they have lots of stuff. And I'm sure it's really fascinating. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA, these are probably technical papers, maybe schematic drawings, things like that. The Institute of Developing Economies in Japan. And then, of course, there are hundreds of universities and colleges around the world that are using these as well. So I am going to turn the podium over to Lisa.
Proprietary software really screws me up.
No.
All right. Well, I can see that open source software is a lot more popular than grazing records. I'm going to be discussing Hoover's implementation of MySQL and PHP. I'll explain what they are, show some examples of our databases and websites, talk about how we handled IT support, and provide my thoughts about how this framework has worked for us. First, real quickly, let me explain how we came to choose MySQL and PHP. 5 years ago, we wanted to we acquired the Firing Line TV program hosted by William F. Buckley. This was a collection of about 1,500 videotapes. We wanted to make them available on the internet in some form, and so we were looking at various digital asset management systems for this purpose. We did ask the Hoover Institution IT staff to help with the selection, but they declined. They were already overworked, having about two people for about 200 employees. So we were on our own. Meanwhile, we had a Stanford electrical engineering student from Thailand, Napadol, who was working at Hoover as an OSHA fellow. He was creating a website for our Radio Free Europe records using MySQL and PHP. Now, we were really gun-shy about the high cost and high risk of purchasing a company's proprietary system, and so we just chose to go with MySQL and PHP. We relied on Stanford students like Napadol to provide support for these systems. So we wound up with what I call a WAMPS array: Windows operating system, Apache server, MySQL database, PHP programming, and those crucial Stanford computer students for database development, web design and programming, and server support. All of the software is open source except Windows. I joined Hoover about when this process started. I was only familiar with Microsoft Access databases, so this was my introduction to open source software, to working with computer programmers, and developing databases for the web. One of the best things about this framework is that it gave me an easy way to learn about designing databases and talking to programmers. So let me tell you a little bit about MySQL. It's a relational database management system. It's open source and freely downloadable from this website. It uses a query language called SQL to perform queries and add remove data. It's cross-platform, so it works on Windows, Unix, a lot of other things. And it's fully networked, so it can be accessed from anywhere in the world. It supports multiple programming languages like PHP, Perl, Java, and a bunch of others. And I'm told it's easy to use, offers speedy performance, and has a rich command set. It also has a development history that goes back to 1979 and became publicly available in 96. And right now it's used in more than 11 million installations worldwide. So this is not a product that's in beta mode. It's mature, it's got a large developer base and a big user base as well. Now the catch is it is command-based, like DOS, so that means you use commands like these to manage the database. Not very appealing these days. And that's where our students and most other people use this graphical user interface, PHP MyAdmin, to manage the database. It lets you do most of the things that you can do in the command line-based MySQL client. So this slide just shows some of the data elements in one table of a relational database. From here, you can add fields, edit field parameters, or view all the records in a database. I've also used this system to add new users to a database. Now we're moving on to PHP now. This is an example of PHP programming. It's embedded in HTML tags. This particular script, which you probably can't read, adds a record. It's executed behind the scenes, so all the data entry person sees is a web-based form. PHP is a relatively simple open source programming language downloadable from this website. It was developed in 1994, has gone through three major rewrites, and is used on more than 20 million domains worldwide. It's a server-side scripting language, and that means that the code is executed by the server, not by the web browser client. And its main purpose is to create dynamic web pages, and that's what we use it for here at Hoover. Just let me say real quick that the SAA Technology Best Practices Task Force just released an online bibliography that includes some links to tutorials for MySQL and PHP. Okay, so at Hoover, we've developed about 8 different databases, each with its own search interface. Most also have an administrative side for our staff to add and edit data, as well as internal metadata that we use for collection management purposes. We are moving away from this project-driven approach and designing one database that we hope will handle a lot of different content. But initially, we develop new databases for each project because the content, the language, or the workflow just seem to warrant separation. For example, this slide shows our Guomindang database. It's a finding aid to microfilmed records of the Taiwan Nationalist Party. All of the data is in Chinese, and we don't plan to translate it into English. Because our students had upgraded to a newer version of MySQL that supports international character sets, it was pretty easy for us to accommodate this data. As I mentioned before, MySQL is fully networked, so access is worldwide. Data entry for some of our projects occurs overseas. One involves a set of mirrored bilingual pages in Russian and English. And so here's one data entry page in Russian, which, my apologies, I don't think most of you can see it. And here's the same data entry page on the mirrored English language version. So someone in Russia is entering data and uploading web quality images, and someone at Hoover in California does quality control and translation into English. We thought that this workflow merited its own database. So until recently, we customized each database for each archival collection. Developing so many databases was a great way for me and my colleagues to learn about metadata fields and values, database design, and web search and display without spending a lot of money on database products and training. But this custom approach also has a lot of drawbacks. For example, it requires a lot of tech support and a lot of documentation. Let me say a little bit about documentation. Everyone says that students don't document, and our students did provide some documentation, though probably not consistently. I'll be the first to admit that. They did seem to think that online information... They seem to think that online documentation, like this MySQL website, was sufficient, and certainly one of the advantages of open source software is this documentation. But some documentation does need to come from our student programmers, and for example, this student created a schema for one of our databases that shows the relation of data elements and tables in the database. But documentation is not just a programmer responsibility. That's one of the big things I've learned in my 5 years doing this. Our staff has to create a lot of the documentation, and this includes the definition and mapping of data elements, as you see here. And also, this is a set of specs that we prepared for our computer student that gives him instructions for creating the web search and browse features for one of our databases. And unfortunately, I'm still learning how important good documentation is years after a database is developed. For example, I regret not recording every decision in great detail about data elements that were considered and included or rejected during the initial development phase. I found that having this information later on saves a lot of time when decisions need to be made and revisited. Most of our databases work pretty much the same way, so I'm going to briefly go through one of them. The one I'm showing describes sound recordings of Commonwealth Club programs. Once our staff developed the data elements, it took less than 50 hours, probably much less, for one of our students to create the actual database. But we're going to be spending years fully populating it, and I think that's one of our biggest problems. In the future, I don't think we can supply all of the data for all of the fields and databases like the ones I'm going to show you now. So this is a typical search interface with keyword and more specific search options. There are instructions that you probably can't read for things like exact phrase and truncated searches. This is the search results page for a search on the words China communism. And then clicking on one of the titles in the search results brings up the detailed record. And the data in blue is linked, so you can click on the speaker name and see all the programs by that speaker. Under collections, you can click on the URL to see a finding aid for a related collection. We also provide a variety of browse options, in this case by program title, by speaker name, and by Library of Congress subject heading. You can click on, this example shows speaker names, which again you probably can't read. And then you click on one of those, and here's the record for one speaker, in this case Dean Rusk. We have recordings of four of his speeches at the Commonwealth Club, and you might barely be able to see those in blue there at the bottom. And you can click on the program titles to view the detailed program record for each of those programs. For bells and whistles, we have a Today in Commonwealth Club history box. The data in that box changes daily without human intervention thanks to PHP scripting. So that's been a really nice feature. So up till now, I've been showing you the front end of the database, what the public sees. This is the back end showing the administrative slide of the program browse list. And and this is the data entry interface. You can see that we update the front end with the current Hoover web appearance, but we don't really bother with the back end. We can also deliver digitized documents online, like photographs, and we can serve streaming audio and video as well. Now, we did have some major problems early on. In 2003, our server was down for the whole summer, and no work could be done on our first databases. Fortunately, we didn't have a lot of content up for the public at that point, so it wasn't quite as devastating. But our computer students were home in Thailand for the summer, and the Hoover IT department couldn't help us out at all. And so we waited till our students got back, and they got us up and running again in the fall. And fortunately, it hasn't happened again. I don't think we would be able to let it happen again now. And later on, we did have a series of security breaches. Our server kept crashing. This time, the Greater Hoover Institution Management got involved. They suggested that we abandon MySQL because they viewed it as easily hackable, just precisely because it was open online. And once again, our students solved the problem by tightening security and upgrading to MySQL version 4.1, which is considered more secure. And since then, pressure from management has dissipated. We haven't had any more hackers get in, and we haven't had any other major problems. So although it's our most mature database, we're still creating reports for the firing line database, and in fact, enhancing the admin side for internal purposes is proving to be our main ongoing activity with our older databases. This is the administrative interface to generate a report that we use to print labels, and here's the report saved as an Excel file. And getting this sort of grid view of the data is useful for a lot of different purposes. I often find it handy. We also have invited users to provide feedback on our firing line website. And here's the online entry survey, or the online survey form they can fill out. And then here's the compilation of feedback on the administrative side. Granted, the colors are really atrocious. But the data has been handy when dealing with managers and donors. I mentioned earlier that we're working on a single database for all formats and content, which will contain all of our reformatting work. Pictured here is an item list of content in that database. And then here's the data entry screen for descriptive metadata. And in this set of data elements, there's a field for genre, like audio or still image. And whatever information you put into that field determines which set of technical fields are displayed for further data entry. Lastly, these are the technical fields to describe an original audio recording. Each copy made from this archival source has a derivative record in the database. So that's a real quick review of the databases and websites that we've created with MySQL and PHP. I think it shows that these applications have a lot of functionality and that a lot of customization is possible. But also a lot of tech support is required, and that leads us to our computer students. We've relied on Stanford students to develop databases and web pages for 5 years. This is the job description written by one of them. Each student found and trained his own successor, which I thought had sort of a paternalistic charm to it. And not coincidentally, they were all from Thailand. They work an average of 6 to 10 hours a week, sometimes including summers and sometimes not. We pay them about double what we pay students who do unskilled work like paging boxes. So at first I was awfully concerned about relying on students for such essential activities, not to mention having or lacking a competitive hiring process for the students. But gradually they really did win me over. I decided ultimately that they were best positioned to select a qualified successor. They were also very professional, and they built a lot of functionality into our systems. And so really I've concluded that they did a great job for us. Right now, though, we've reached a crossroads with our IT support. Our last student couldn't find a replacement last spring, and the Hoover Institution just hired a full-time programmer. We're told that the programmer will work chiefly for the Hoover Archives, but while we directly supervised our computer students, we don't directly supervise this programmer. So we'll have to see how this new system works out over time, but so far, I have to admit, it's gone really well. Our students did provide a comfortable space for me to build up my IT communication skills, and I feel much more comfortable communicating now with this new professional programmer than I think I would have otherwise. So what are my conclusions from all of this? I think we have a lot of positive results. We created a set of highly functional, low-cost, customized databases for databases and websites for diverse projects. We used non-proprietary applications, as archival best practice recommends. My colleagues and I learned a lot about database design at little cost. By directly supervising our students, the archives maintain direct control over its systems, which I have to admit I feel more comfortable about. And Hoover management really liked the low cost of the open source student approach. That, I think that's what they like very best of all. Of course, we had some problems, though none of them, I think, are directly related to open source software. Of course, the main one is that we have multiple databases that must be individually searched and individually maintained and individually documented. And there may be more problems maintaining so many different databases into the future. Of course, we had some major technical problems when students were gone for the summer. And lastly, our students couldn't work enough hours to do everything that we wanted because their schoolwork came first, and also they were international students who had limits on the number of hours they could work. But in summary, I hope that we continue to use this open source software for a long time, and I think that will depend on whether our new full-time IT staff can support it as well as our students did. So thank you.
I wanted to let you know that all the PowerPoint slides are going to be put online. The SAA has the new web page for the conference, so you can get any of the URLs mentioned here online. And I'd like to start the questions out by asking the panel. They've done a lot with choosing and then implementing the software. If they could tell each one could pick one important question that they should that everybody should ask when they start to evaluate software for their own institution, what they consider the most critical element maybe, and I know it's hard to choose, but and then there's a wireless microphone that I'm going to go get since this session is being taped, and then we'll take questions.
I think the most important question would be, what do you really want the functionality to be? And then work backwards from there and developing your questions on what do you really need to have and what can you support and what are you going to get?
I guess I would be really...
Okay, I'm back on. I guess I would pay close attention to the capability for hierarchies in the system, since archival work is so hierarchical.
I would go to the whole other end of the spectrum and say, do I have some IT people that can help? Because the reality of it is that a lot of us do not have the programming experience and the Java language and all the Oracle. I took some Oracle classes and things like that, and even I cannot build one of these systems on my own. And I think that was the most essential. I think that becomes the most critical thing. Do you have somebody that can help you with all the programming and technical stuff?
Okay. Amy's will be around with the microphone for questions. I know somebody has to have questions out there. You're such a large audience.
Hi. I really enjoyed the presentation, but I noticed that, I mean, these are all very large institutions. Do you have any recommendation for a smaller or medium-sized repository?
We may be large as an institution, but staff-wise and knowledge-wise, we're in kindergarten. I think anybody starting out, unless you have, like Jennifer said, a really very well-involved technical support team, like Berkeley had for the Making of America 2 project that we worked with them on, if they're dedicated to it, no sweat. But starting out, small institution, or even a one-person shop, or a large institution with a small staff, you're all in the same boat. You just have to find your resources and learn what you need to know and who's going to be able to help you.
And I would say that when you're talking about like the project that I worked at, yes, University of Maryland was a large institution. However, Mount St. Mary's now, I mean, we're talking about 2,000, 3,000 students and a very, very, very tiny operating budget for the archives. And we're looking into a DSpace instance. And with the NITLE project, most of those institutions are very small liberal arts colleges that are looking into this. So it's absolutely possible. Of course, the larger the institution, maybe you get more help. But it doesn't always equal more help and more and better success with the project.
And I'll say, too, I mean, Hoover has maybe 20 people on the archive staff, and including no IT support. And that's why we looked out to the student community. And even if you're not a repository on a university campus, if there's a campus nearby that has a computer science program, you might look at something like that as a way to get started for IT support. And students are very, they have their good and bad points, but they are easy to deal with, and they are pretty excited and can be very helpful. And if you don't have a lot invested in a system and can afford to be down, say, for the summer, it's a good way to get going with a very minimal initial investment.
Other questions?
This question's actually for Jennifer about the DSpace digital repository. I was wondering how many of the groups on campus there used it for preserving websites and whether or not it's very effective for that.
That's a good question, and it has the capability to do that. We actually did not have anyone that, at least thus far, has decided to use it for that purpose. Most of the people who initially came to put things in the collections were some of our research institutes that are based in different departments that had large collections of working papers that they were trying to find a way to make available, and we're doing some kind of patchwork web work and relational databases behind the scenes, and it wasn't always reliable. But we did not have people do it, but it is absolutely possible to do that with the system. It will take those pages.
I know I saw at least one hand start to go up right over here.
Yes, I'd like to ask Lisa how difficult the mapping was between, say, relational database management system like MySQL and XML. And did you get the, from the end user's perspective, are you getting the results that you want after doing that mapping?
Well, we actually haven't exported anything to any XML format at this point. We're not using any particular XML systems. I'm not sure if that's what your question is, but...
Are these, say, collection finding aids in the database?
They're not finding aids. They're, they're usually item-level descriptive and technical information for materials in our in different collections. So it's not at the finding aid level.
This one.
Turn the mic on.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. This is for Jennifer. When you're doing distributed collecting, I've heard and have had personal experience with the problem of getting faculty to actually input the records and the data. And the question is, how do you solve that problem? Because otherwise the library then has to physically go talk to everyone and do that, and that's just not possible, even on a small size campus. So what's the solution to that?
That's a good question. And faculty are not always, and I'm sure, the question was about that often faculty are not as reliable about putting all that descriptive data in and filling out the records the way they should. So what happens? Because then the library has to do it, and that's obviously not always possible. And I'm sure a lot of you have dealt with faculty, and they are not always the most reliable about doing what you've asked them to do or what you expect that they'll do. And we did run into that problem quite a bit, where we had certain faculty members that were absolutely fantastic. They filled out every single piece of information that was put on the form, and it was great. And then we had others that filled out almost nothing. And the results were that people couldn't find some things. And yes, that what we did was we utilized a system of you can set up collection administrators or community administrators that are people within the department who will have the ability to approve the items that are coming in. So, for instance, in one of our technology institutes, their administrative assistant was she had been already sort of cataloging and describing these working papers and putting them out on the web. So it was a very easy switch to make her an administrator for their DSpace collection, their particular community. And she reviewed all of the files, all of the records before they actually went into the system, made sure that things were looking okay. And then ultimately what would happen is if things were still blank and they really, really needed to be filled in, then the graduate assistant who was in charge of DRUM was responsible for kind of taking a look and seeing if you could put some other descriptors in. You know, we still haven't solved that problem entirely. And yes, it does lead to decreased functionality because, of course, you can't find something if, you know, if you're just searching for something and you don't know it exists, it's hard to find it if there aren't any descriptors. But we did find that most faculty were willing to put at least a few keywords in. And even that was better than nothing.
My question was for Jennifer as well. I wanted to know if the self-catalogers were using any sort of controlled vocabulary, and if not, do you foresee that as being a concern in the future?
Can you say it again? I'm sorry.
Are your self-catalogers using any sort of controlled vocabulary?
No. Currently, And of course, I don't work at University of Maryland right now, so I can't say a whole lot about what they're hoping for in the future. Now, we did, as part of the project team, we had one of the library's catalogers on the team helping us to decide which Dublin Core metadata tags were going to be the most effective and which should be filled out. We did not use any controlled vocabulary. You could, if you wanted to, and have them pick. We found that it was actually more effective to have the faculty and the depositors enter what they thought was a really good, gave a good sense of what the paper was about, just because of the jargon. I think that a lot of users are researching, and when they're doing searches, they're not using that, you know, how many library users have you helped with a research request, and they have no idea what controlled vocabulary to use. You know, and so I think in a lot of ways it was easier, but you could have that possibility if you wanted to ask them to use specific controlled vocabulary. You could certainly do that.
That brings me a question. Since I'm very big into controlled vocabulary, can you add your own controlled vocabulary in addition to the keywords that they've put in?
Absolutely.
And indicate that it is the controlled vocabulary source?
I'm not sure about indicating whether it's a controlled vocabulary source, but you can certainly create a controlled vocabulary list that you would like people to also use, or when any item that's deposited goes through an authorization process. So it comes to some administrator, whether that's a graduate student at just the very whole institutional repository level or whether that's at a community level. And that person can make any changes necessary. We often found that faculty like to misspell things, even their own names, and they didn't double check what they had written. And so we often were just looking and finding some of those little things, but you could certainly add a controlled vocabulary, couple terms as you went, things, and that would be somewhere that probably you'd want a librarian or a cataloger to do that kind of stuff.
I have a question for, I think, Lisa Miller. Does any of your programming or does your database relate at all to the digital files, preservation or storage of the digital assets? And I'm just curious how that works in, if it's a separate table or if you have dealt with that at all.
So we're collecting a lot of technical metadata about things that we digitize, and that information is going into the databases now. It's usually in separate sets of tables. I don't know if there's more to say at this point. You know, we aren't at the point where we've had to go back and refer to that information to make management or maintenance or preservation sorts of decisions, but we are more just beginning to collect it with our more recent databases.
I had just a comment about the question about controlled vocabulary and searching. One thing you have to think about first is if you want to have full text searching enabled in DSpace, users much prefer that, and few users are going to actually browse subject headings. So that's one thing to think about. Another is that if you've been successful in getting the libraries involved as a whole in an institutional repository effort, and if there's some sort of mandate, then libraries liaisons, you know, the subject liaisons are absolutely terrific if they view it as part of their job to work with faculty, work with departments, and maybe even do some of the ingest, because we have not had good luck with faculty doing that themselves, but to also add really good subject terms.
There's a question up here in the corner.
Yes, I was wondering, it seems like one of the big advantages of DSpace is that self-cataloging approach. What about the other Content DM and the PHP or SQL PHP? Is there any thinking of sort of incorporating that type of feature, or can you do that?
I think the question was about self-depositing, self-cataloging in MySQL PHP and in Content DM. We haven't done any work with self-cataloging by depositors at our repository. We don't receive materials from a university campus. We're collecting worldwide in particular subject areas, so we don't work with campus faculty all that much. We haven't really explored that at all, but I certainly think it would be possible. Yeah.
We use Content DM for photograph collections, and there's an administrative component that you have to have permission to write to it. So it's not open for outside people to get access to it, to add anything. So, no.
If I can follow up real quick, we do have some people overseas who are doing data entry into a couple of our databases. And we do find that we're going back and checking all their work real carefully and doing a lot of editing. Partly if they're entering it in English, they usually need some help with their English language skills. And so we have to go along behind them and fix it up. But also if we could better anticipate and provide better guidelines up front about exactly what data we want in each field and how it should look, it might save us some of the QC after the fact. And so we're thinking about that as we move into the future. And also trying to use more pull-down menus and pick lists and things where the data entry people have to do less work.
Typically, archives collect materials which they don't make open to the public immediately. Do these systems, Susan may have just answered this, but my question is, do these systems allow you to collect and close materials for a specified period of time?
At least in our database, we have a restrictions note, and if something is restricted at the item or the file level, it would not be able to be seen by a researcher, but the system right now has no public interface, so they can't see anything. The whole intent is when we find something that will be a public interface that we can use for cross-searching across collections, that functionality will be there, that you can see this part of the collection but not that, like student records and whole series that they couldn't be accessing.
DSpace also allows for that, and it comes in most notably because you're dealing with a lot of peer-reviewed articles that are being published. We often get items that are about to be published or items that maybe have been published, and they may have been published fairly recently. And there is a way that you can restrict their inclusion in the system so that you can see the descriptive elements. Well, that's what we did, but you can choose to close it entirely until like maybe 6 months or a year, depending on what the arrangement with the publisher was and the copyright that exists on it.
And likewise, with MySQL and PHP, we do have databases where we can indicate at the record, each record level, whether we want it open to the public or closed.
I think in the interest of the audio recording, we should at least record what our URL is for finding the PowerPoints so that people who are listening will be able to then go to the computer and find it. For Sue Hamburger's, it's www.personal.psu.edu/sxh36/.
I have no idea.
Mine is not. Maybe Susan would be willing to put ours with hers. Is that possible? Or on the wiki?
Well, it'll be on.
It won't.
We'll put them all on the wiki through the SAA website for the 2007 conference. Is there any additional questions somebody's thought of in the meantime? Well, I'd like to thank all three of our speakers and enjoy the rest of your conference.